North Idaho News of the Week is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty, commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com. Good morning and happy Flag Day. You've tuned in to North Idaho News of the Week on Friday, June 14th. This is 88.5 KRFY. My name is Jack Peterson, and I'm here, as usual, with Chris Bessler. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. How are you doing on this beautiful day?
It is a beautiful day. I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
It's been, the sun is out. The sun is shining right now. I'm not looking at the forecast. We're just pretending summer is here, and it's here to stay.
Might be a different story tomorrow. Actually, the last report I saw was for 35% chance of rain and high in the higher 50s or low 60s,
something
so
like that.
So we might have a little change tomorrow, but enjoy the day because it's beautiful.
We need the moisture, as I always say. That's kind of the looking at the silver lining on that cloud. We're joined this morning by the editor of the Sandpoint Reader, Mr. Zach Hagedon. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning.
And Sansre Mitchell, a staff writer, the staff writer.
For the one and only.
Yeah, for the Sandpoint Reader. Hi, good morning, Sansre. Nice to have you back on the airwaves.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
And we'll start with a rundown of the headlines. Still, the big story in town remains the Albany Falls Dam repairs. The lake level, though, is coming up and coming up fast. The full pool is now expected June 23rd, which is a week from Sunday. And it looks like it's only about a foot or a foot and a half shy of full pool right now. So most lake uses are now available, I guess. Two appeals have been filed against the Panhandle Bike Ranch conditional use permit. We mentioned this one last week, but we'll talk a little bit more about the details of that on this morning's show, see where things are going with the proposed Panhandle Bike Ranch. Also in recreational news, the Camp Bay Lake access has been stalled until the final path is completed next year. Camp Bay right now is inaccessible, and it looks like it won't be accessible for the rest of this year, at least to the public, while the development continues out there. In West Bonner County, the junior high will be closed as part of an effort to close that nearly $4.7 million shortfall brought about by the failure of the levee in West Bonner County. The next meeting to discuss the finances is on Monday, June 17th. Avril Hospitality has announced their plans for the Edgewater Hotel, right adjacent to City Beach here in downtown Sandpoint. And the announcement has sparked a great deal of interest and some controversy. The Idaho Transportation Department has canceled the East Alignment Bypass in Sagal that they had proposed to go around the town of Sagal to the east and cut through some longstanding family farms and other properties. They have canceled that plan. And also Sagal, the Sagal and Westside Fire Districts have approved a joint powers agreement absent the Sandpoint Fire District. And the Sandpoint Fire Department will officially be created on July 1st. And that's the news.
That's a good collection of headlines there.
That's what's going on.
A bit of diversity, things going on.
Before we get into the Avril thing, which I would like to do, should we start with Zach? And can you explain what's going on in that joint powers, the new joint powers agreement? Because that's an interesting story, but it's also kind of complicated for those who haven't been following along for the last 10 months or so since it kind of made headlines the first time.
Right, yeah. So I guess by way of background, we started talking about this last September when the former Selkirk Fire Joint Powers Agreement came up before the city council. A couple of the firefighters, leaders of the union, the firefighter union, suggested at a meeting in September that they were unhappy with the leadership of the Joint Powers Agreement, which is literally what it suggests, you know, in its name. It's a joint powers agreement. So it's an agreement between all these different entities, fire districts, who agree to sort of share resources and finances and, you know, basically create a regional fire service through their partnership. So it was seemed to come out of nowhere, at least to me, who hadn't really been following sort of fire politics. Yeah. But that story we ended up writing in September kind of revealed that the union was unhappy with the way that the joint powers agreement was being handled, insofar as it wasn't very safe for them to go out understaffed on a lot of these calls, and they were looking for a reorganization and an improvement to the way that the administration was handled so that they could more adequately staff themselves on these calls. That also came about right before their contract negotiations, which occurred throughout the spring. And really what it sort of culminated with in sort of March, April, was a total reckoning, like re-reckoning with how we do fire service. The Joint Powers Agreement, the JPA, was only about 4 years old. So the way we'd been doing this wasn't actually like sort of our traditional model. It was it was a new-ish way of doing it. Mayor Jeremy Grimm, when he ran for office, was very vocal about supporting the firefighters in their struggles with the JPA. But then once in office, kind of changed his tune to the point where he was one of the most vocal advocates for getting rid of it. Joined with, you know, Council President Deb Rule, who had a long history of dealing with this issue, and she was very much in favor of removing Sandpoint from the JPA. So that conversation was ongoing. Then we reached sort of a point in April where the members of the JPA, so the Sagal and the Westside Fire Districts, had come up with an idea of creating an enhanced version of this agreement that would make it more of a regional fire authority as opposed to a JPA. The city of Sandpoint's legal team looked at that and concluded that there was nothing in Idaho code that would enable that to be created. The JPA said, well, give us time to figure out how we can massage it so that we can do it legally before you decide to pull out. The city said, we're not going to wait for that because we don't know what the outcome is going to be. Meanwhile, we have to budget, so we're not going to sort of hold off on budgeting. So we'll just go our own way, and you guys can have your own JPA and see how it works out. The city is open, at least it's expressed that it might be open to rejoining a joint powers agreement at some point in the future, depending on whether or not these entities can create the sort of enhanced structure that they've said they want to create. Meanwhile, we're going to have a fire department again. And I think there's some excitement about that among the mayor. Some of the council members have seemed very excited about the idea that we're going to have our own branded fire department. So we're going to see Sandpoint Fire Department trucks driving around.
And how do the firemen like this?
Well, I mean, the members of the JPA have retained their agreement, you know, Sagal and Westside. So I think they liked this model. So I think they're kind of going their own way. And I think that works for them to supply service to the outer areas of the county. I think that the budgeting authorities in the city of Sandpoint like this because it is just simpler. You know, we're going to have 9 personnel, Sandpoint firefighters. They're all going to be based here in Sandpoint at Fire Station 1. Prior to this, the Joint Powers Agreement, all the members of the JPA were technically Sandpoint employees, even though they worked maybe out in Renko or Sagal or whatever. So the city was handling all of the payroll and the HR. We don't have to do that anymore. So I'm pretty sure that like the Treasurer's Department probably likes this a lot.
Is that number 9 firefighters, is that the same as it was under the JPA? Or?
It's hard to say. Because of the way the JPA operated, we were always shuffling firefighters between stations. So it was, I mean, you never really knew. You know, somebody might be off for the day. So, I mean, technically we had about 9 on any given day throughout the whole area. So not just Sandpoint, but like Sagal, Westside. The entire JPA service area would have about 9 firefighters on. So I guess from what this looks like, we're going to always have about 9 just for Sandpoint. So presumably that's, you know, a more consistent coverage for the city.
And it, like in the event of a fire, the fire department does a lot of different things. But in the event of a fire, which is what you think of the fire department for, that is outside of Sandpoint city limits, but Sandpoint's the closest fire department. I assume, I guess, that they would still be called and would be on the scene.
We still have mutual aid agreements with everybody, so it's not like people are erecting sort of boundaries around these districts and saying, like, in no way, shape, or form would I ever come out and help you put out a fire. It's like, no, if the situation warrants it, we're still going to be helping each other out throughout the region.
Yeah.
It's just that I think the administration is going to be very different. And, you know, the way that equipment procurement is done is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're still going to do some co-training together because that makes sense to have everybody sort of trained on the same basic stuff. So it is a change. And I guess we're just going to see how it plays out. I mean, it may well be that we decide in the future that a joint powers agreement is better, looking at the growth we have in the county.
Mm-hmm.
And we may well rejoin something like that. I mean, the mayor said as much in his comments. But for now, just look forward to seeing Sandpoint Fire Department trucks starting in July.
I'm guessing we'll see them in the 4th of July parade, for that matter. Let's see. Sansaray, shall we discuss should we start with the bypass? What's going on?
Is it Sagal bypass?
I guess when you say the bypass, you kind of, people think you're thinking of the existing one in Sandpoint, but this was the proposed bypass in Sagal, and it is now totally dead, or is it on life support? Or
how, so we're in a little bit of a gray area right now. The proposed route that sort of it curved southeast and went through a lot of farmland, like you mentioned, a lot of low-income homes. I think we estimated about 22 would have been in the path of the bulldozers. They have decided going forward that they're not going to pursue that. It's still the recommended route by everyone, but they basically said, no, we're not going to do that. It would have made the current US 95 into just a little town road and then gone out and had different bypasses to access different areas, because of course we all know right in that corridor, it's pretty hectic to try and get off the highway. And so they've been doing a lot of research into that with environmental studies, which are still ongoing, and they decided that the proposed route would have would create too much noise for nature areas and housing.
It would have run right past Sagal Elementary School.
That too, as well.
That was a big deal to people. I mean, beyond the idea that, you know, these farmland areas and homes themselves might have been eminent domained, if it came to that, but also the idea of having, you know, like a highway running about, what was it, 100 yards or something from Sagal Elementary School.
And the idea for a bypass was that they would have an unimpeded route for the highway traffic. So they would have had frontage roads or something,
right?
Because they would have restricted access. Yeah.
Yes, there would have been two, I believe, frontage roads and then several offshoots. It would have been a little octopus out there in Sagal.
And massive, really, for that rural, barely a town. Yeah,
it would have been a bigger sort of undertaking than the Athol bypass, I think, is what at one point people were like, oh, compare it to Athol. But you look at it and it's like, no, the Athol bypass is like half as big as what this was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. So what going forward then, what's it? What now?
It's unknown? Too early to tell.
Okay.
They're still, like I said, doing studies, and they do need to fix it because there are a lot of accidents and a lot of difficulties around there, but they're just not sure what to do going forward.
Huh. Okay.
There's another meeting, right, that they're talking about. I mean, they don't have a date for it yet, but they said they're going to meet again in the fall to kind of go back to the drawing board.
I guess I don't even know what the options are. Could you go to the west or, I don't know, or elevate? How about a tunnel? I don't know.
It's a bit too wet for a tunnel.
A single tunnel.
There was an idea for a tunnel.
Really?
To replace our existing Sandpoint bypass.
Oh, okay.
Instead of the Sandpoint bypass, the tunnel under. Yeah. That was an actual proposal that some people were pushing for some period of time there.
West Bonner County, we've been talking about this every week, but you've actually been covering it more in depth. So I guess what's the latest? I just read your story in the Reader. They're going to close Priest River Junior High. That's a very prominent building as you go through Priest River. It's the old historic faced building that's right there on Highway 2. And they're going to close it, but because it's a historic building, they're going to keep it somewhat operational. I mean, they're not going to, like, completely shutter it. They have to maintain it still. They still have to budget for maintenance. But they're going to keep the elementary schools open.
Yes. Right?
All of them?
All of them. That was the big debate. They were initially thinking about closing multiple schools, not just the junior high. That was something that was proposed by the board. But ultimately, after hearing a lot of testimony from families at Priest Lake Elementary specifically, they decided that it would be less of an impact on the community and on the children if they just shuttered the junior high. It also worked out financially because, as you said, that is such a historic building. I believe they said it was a bomb shelter back in the day. Yeah. But it's got ancient windows. It's very drafty, so it's quite expensive to heat and maintain. There was an estimate about 3 years ago that basically to get it up to code now, it would take about $16 million. They estimated during the meeting that 7 or 8 would be passable. But of course, we don't have 7 or 8 million in that district. So they do have to still maintain it. They'll have to keep it at about 65 or 70 degrees so that the pipes don't freeze. And so there is a possibility that in the future that building could be used for something else. But according to everyone at the meeting, it's very unlikely that it'll open as a school again.
This all... These hard conversations are coming about because, more or less directly, because the proposed levy that was on the ballot in May failed to pass. They could have kept all the schools open had that passed, but it didn't. Are you seeing any like response in the community about that levy, and especially about the idea of a levy going forward? Are people saying, like, oh, now that I see schools are going to be closed, I would have changed my vote or something like that, or I would vote for a different levy next time?
There was talk about that most of the voters just basically didn't show up to the polls. And so I would hope going forward that they would more actively participate. All of the Priest Lake families were talking about how their area usually pulls the levy through every year, and they voted the same way this year, so it was all of the other surrounding areas. And since Priest Lake was basically the first one on the chopping block, even though they went with the junior high, it seemed like the only people who were going to be punished were the ones who actively wanted the levy. So I'm not sure if anybody who voted against it has actually changed their tune. But it's important to remember that even with the $4.7 million-ish levy, it would not have covered all of our budgeting issues going forward. They're still relying on federal funds coming in, and now, of course, they've set up a grants and fundraising sort of subcommittee that's going to look into essentially raising the money that would have come from the levy, except from willing donations from local families, and hopefully families in other school districts as well.
Yeah.
I think Inovia Foundation is also involved too, right?
Yes. They are meant to set up an endowment fund, which I believe would make all of the donations tax deductible and also invest the money so that it could grow over the years. The only hurdle is that in order to set up the endowment fund, they need an initial, I believe it was $10,000, yes, to put down to just start the fund, and then that would go into the endowment fund. It would not be accessible. That would just open the fund, and then after that, all of the donations going into there would be accessible. People would be able to choose whether they go into the endowment fund and accumulate more money over the years, or whether we can use them immediately for things like teacher salaries, school maintenance.
I see.
Yeah, in an endowment fund, you can't touch the principal, so you just get the interest that's thrown off to use for your purpose.
You say here the board has yet to decide whether it will add another levy to the ballot this November, but there could be one on November 2024's ballot.
There very well could be. I asked Margaret Hall, and she essentially said, you know, we haven't voted on that, so we can't confirm nor deny anything. It was brought up at the meeting, but it was pushed to the side because, of course, that money wouldn't be accessible until 2025, 2026. So they said that's a future problem.
Right. Do you know when they have to make that decision to get it on the ballot?
I don't know when that what the timeline is for that, because it is a heavy lift, you know, to get stuff on the ballot. I mean, they could try to rerun the exact same levy. You know, they already have all the documentation and the language and everything like that. But there is a deadline they would have to meet to get that on the ballot. And I think the county clerk would probably be the one to ask about that.
Yeah. Well, with anything else to say about, I guess, what's going on out in West Bonner County? Have they officially determined who their superintendent's going to be? Or is that...
They haven't made any announcement on that recently.
No. Okay. But they are down to just the one applicant, I think, because they had two and one dropped out. So
yes.
I don't know. Okay. Should we talk about the Averill announcement?
That's the big the big piece.
And Chris, you spoke to Brian Averill. And
Brian Averill and Justin Dahl from Averill Hospitality. They were in here on Wednesday for the morning show.
And this is the Edgewater Hotel, that hotel that has been there.
They acquired the hotel about 2 years ago from Sandida, a local company. Mm-hmm. The Cox family actually owns that. And of course, it's no surprise that the hotel is very aged from the go. The Cox family was considering replacing it themselves for many years. And there's a lot of talk about that. So there's no surprise that the hotel is going to be redeveloped. And the announcements that came out this week here on KRFY, but they've been reaching out to the reader, the Bee, they gave talks at the Rotary Club and the Sandpoint Chamber's general membership luncheon yesterday. They're showing their renderings for the building, as well as they're getting ready because they have a public hearing next Tuesday before the Sandpoint Planning and Zoning Commission on their application for a conditional use permit. That's required by the building code due to the square footage of the building. But they're also asking for a variance, and that's a kind of an interesting point. The commercial A zone that they're in requires them to build right to the property line if they don't get a variance, which would make the already large structure even larger if they had to build all the way to the property line. They're requesting setbacks from that so that they can, as you enter the city beach, if you can imagine that sidewalk that's right there in front of the Edgewater, if a building came all the way to the edge of that. They're looking for a setback for that. So it feels like a kind of no-brainer sort of thing for the city to approve these setbacks. As well as you'll recall that the city, about a year and a half ago, they did a land trade, and they traded the area that's the lawn in front of the Edgewater, which the city owned at that time, for the lot across the street from the Edgewater, where the city right now is intending to move the boat ramp at City Beach to that location. It's just part of the plan. We'll see if that ever develops out. But the Averill Hospitality now owns the property all the way to the sidewalk that parallels there in front of the current hotel. And the renderings show that, you know, they want quite a bit of setback from the sidewalk. And the building itself is going to be at the same height as the Seasons next door. So I believe that's 65 feet. That's the maximum. That falls within the code. But it's the shape of a big E, if you can envision that. The footprint of the building is the shape of a big E, and it has like three wings that reach out towards the water. And then it has two recessed areas that they're calling courtyards. And then one courtyard would have a swimming pool and be for hotel guests. The other courtyard is intended to be a event meeting space. And they're building something that we don't currently have in Sandpoint right now, and that is a facility that can host meetings and conventions and those sorts of things on site at a hotel. So they're going to have a ballroom that can seat approximately 350 people, and they have some other little breakout, smaller meeting areas as well. And that one courtyard that's most to the north would be an area where people could gather during the summer for outdoor sorts of events. Like we have a lot of outdoor events at the Edgewater there. And the room count's going to be 150 to 170, and that is about triple the current room count that that the Edgewater has. They plan to have a few different restaurants in the building. And there's going to be a restaurant that's right on the water in the southeast corner of the property. They're calling it what they have. Averill is based out of Whitefish, where they have a couple hotels. They also own a hotel in Missoula. They also have several restaurants. In Whitefish, they have a similar, apparently, I haven't been there, but they have a similar restaurant that's right close to the water. They call it the Tiki Bar. So for now, they're calling this, it's a separate structure away from the main hotel. They're calling it the Tiki Bar. That would be, especially in summer, it'd be completely open so people could go in flip-flops and bathing suits and hang out or get something to eat. Of course, a ton of interest in this. We posted it on the KRFY Facebook page as well as the Sandpoint Online Facebook page. And I just took a look at the reach now. It's about 19,000 people, which is a lot more than a typical post on Facebook gets. And that's because people are commenting on it and sharing it. Of course, the big thing there is that you can see the renderings. So folks that are interested in this, go to the KRFY Facebook page and take a look at the renderings if you want to see how the new Edgewater might look. And you guys have probably looked at the renderings. So, some people are saying they love them and some people are saying they don't like them. So it's a matter of taste, I guess. It's kind of I don't know how you would describe the architecture. It's multi-level, so it's not just a big block of a building there. It has some kind of interesting post features that I don't know. It's kind of a mountain town sort of vibe, I guess.
It's lodgy kind of, but a little more airy than that, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And of course, the thing is with these renderings, like they're cartoon in nature, and they always are. We've seen all kinds of different projects get proposed around town, and I don't know how often they actually end up looking exactly like they do in the pictures. So I think these are more concepts, right? I mean, nothing's been approved.
Of course.
And then there's going to be design discussions, and this process really hasn't even started yet.
They actually anticipate that they'll be going through a design process for basically a full year. And that the construction, which would start with demolition, as it currently stands, would probably happen next spring. So we're a year off from that. And in that intervening time, they'll be doing the architectural and design and engineering work that they need to do to build it. Also, I should mention that the parking lot for this remains where the current parking lot is, but it's going to be two levels. So they're going to be able to accommodate over 200 cars there, they're anticipating. So that'll be quite a bit different, but it's going to be in the same location. So it'll be along, I think it's called either Sandpoint Dock Street or Sandpoint Avenue is the official name of it. But that avenue that goes into the Seasons and then over to the Pend Oreille Bay Trail, of course, it remains open. They are going to enlarge the sidewalk that's in front about halfway down through the property. They're going to make it big enough, 26 feet wide, because they actually need that as a fire lane. So there'll be kind of a broad boulevard sort of feel to that sidewalk. And then the sidewalk will continue on to the street that accesses the Windbag Marina there. And if you go to the Facebook page and look at these renderings. If you look at the site plan rendering, it lists out the different amenities they're talking about with the hotel entry area. There's going to be an outdoor restaurant deck in the main building along with that tiki bar I described. There's going to be what they call the pool courtyard with different amenities in it. And then the event courtyard that's going to have sunken fire pits, a reflecting pool, a banquet deck. And then there'll be a banquet plaza. So it's going to be quite a bit larger, but I guess opinions will vary.
150 rooms is pretty ambitious, tripling the current room count.
Right. And that's basically by going up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they do have more square footage on the ground as well, because they have these three wings, but they're not building the whole building across the entire,
yeah,
which is what I was kind of envisioning,
right,
when I was thinking about the fact that they had acquired that property all the way to the sidewalk, mm-hmm, in front of the lake, that there's just going to be this massive structure there, but it's not that.
Is there demand for triple the amount of rooms in that hotel?
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In summer.
In summer.
In summer, right. But so they're emphasizing that the reason they're putting in the meeting facilities is to help us in our tourism shoulder seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So because that's, you know, spring and fall, the occupancy rate here in our hotels is well below what they can hold. And even in winter, the downtown hotels have a really low occupancy rate. So they're really trying to position it as a meeting space. But 350 people in a grand, in the big room, it's not a big hotel. I mean, big hotels can hold 2-3. They have multiple meeting rooms like that. So it's still, in comparison to other, what you might see in Spokane and the larger hotels or any big city, it's still a lot smaller. But it would be a capacity we don't have right now here in town.
Yeah. Well, as always, we've gone over. We didn't even mention the bike ranch conditional use permit debate. There's two, or we mentioned it in the headlines, but there's the applicant has filed an appeal as well as opponents to the application. Contesting appeals, and there will be hearing at least one hearing, a couple hearings coming up to talk about those, right, Sansaray?
Yes, the Bonner County Board of Commissioners will be hearing that on Monday, June 24th. And if anyone wants to comment, written appeals are due to the County Planning Department by June 17th.
Mm-hmm. This has become a real hot button issue in that area anyway. Can you explain to those of us who don't live there why this is so controversial? Does it? I mean, to me, it seems like putting in trails in an existing wooded area doesn't seem like a huge impact to the area compared to what else you might use that land for.
That is the argument that a lot of people are making. I've heard talk from the local real estate agents saying, oh, thank gosh, it's not a subdivision or another 30 houses. But the issue with locals is that it's going to be a lot of increased traffic on the road leading up to it. So not so much an issue with the bikers themselves, but the shuttles running, the cars, and then also there will be campsites on there for the bikers, which will generate possibly more noise, more trash, things in the area.
Okay. That's the...
But the bikes are not motorized, so...
No.
That, yeah. It's not
to keep things a little quieter.
What do you call that? Not a motocross course carved in the woods. Okay. Well...
Better mention, it's Flag Day. I don't think we mentioned that here yet on the air. Quiz, Jack.
Okay.
What is Flag Day about? Why do we have Flag Day?
For flags. It's for... you put up, I'm guessing this would be like in reference to Betsy Ross creating the first American flag.
Yeah, you're close. It commemorates the adoption of the flag. And actually on June 14th, 1777, before we even really had a country, we were still fighting the war then. So, you'll see flags around town. I think they're put up by the Lions Club. So thank you to our service group to get out and remind us that, hey, the flag's a symbol of what we aspire to.
Yeah.
And they're flying right side up, I'm happy to say.
Right.
Well, without further comment on that, I think we can wrap it up. It has been a pleasure to talk to the staff of the Sandpoint Reader today. The Reader is currently on newsstands, jam-packed with more details on everything we've talked about this morning, plus a lot more.
Big cover on Art Walk, which is tonight.
Right.
You guys going to walk around and check out the art?
Might do it, yeah.
Always. Yeah. It's in our building, too.
So it is in our building.
We already got a sneak peek.
Yeah, we see it every time we go upstairs.
Next week's Reader, anything you want to tease out for us?
Well, we're definitely going to follow up on this Averill project at the beach. I mean, we're going to be watching the meeting on Tuesday and hopefully having some more information about some of the nuts and bolts of the project.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of moving away from the announcement aspect of it and to looking more at like how they're actually going to pull this off.
Yeah.
The $70 million price tag they put on it, I'll be curious to see if they can stay within that, considering, you know, the inflation pressures on building materials.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see if the numbers they're giving about sort of the tax revenue are realistic. So, yeah, it'll be a wonky story about a beach hotel.
Okay. We'll watch for that in next week's Reader. Sansari Mitchell is the staff writer for the Sandpoint Reader. Zach Hagedon, the editor. Thanks to both of you for your time this morning. Mm-hmm. And we'll continue now with Otto's Eclectic Mix. And then Burt Note comes up at 9 o'clock, I guess. Here's the Doobie Brothers on 88.5 KRFY.